Sounds True presents The Inner Art of Meditation, an introduction to Vipassana, or Buddhist Insight Meditation, with Jack Kornfield. Jack Kornfield is one of the senior teachers of insight meditation in America. He is an ordained Buddhist monk, has trained in Thailand, Burma, and India, and has taught meditation worldwide since 1974. Jack Kornfield was educated at Dartmouth, worked in public health with the Peace Corps in Asia, and later completed a PhD in clinical psychology. Jack is a husband, father, psychotherapist, and a founding teacher of the Insight Meditation Society and the Spirit Rock Center in Woodacre, California. For many years, his work has been focused on bringing alive the Great Eastern spiritual teachings in an integrated, accessible way for Western students. His books include Seeking a Heart of Wisdom, A Still Forest Pool, Stories of the Spirit, and his new book, A Path with Heart, Through the Perils and Promises of Spiritual Life. The Inner Art of Meditation documents a series of 5 experiential classes recorded live in Marin County, California. As an introduction to this series, we will begin The Inner Art of Meditation with excerpts from an introductory lecture by Jack Kornfield called Why Meditate? And now, The Inner Art of Meditation with Jack Kornfield.
I'd like to speak a little bit about the heart of the practice, meditation, by posing some questions, which may or may not be ones that you have. They're at least ones that I think I have an answer to, and then responding to them. What's the essence of meditation practice? Shortly after the Buddha was enlightened, there's a story that he was walking down the road, met some people who saw him, and he was in a very happy state. He was supposed to have been quite a handsome prince before his going off to be a monk. So here's this handsome prince, now wearing golden robes and recently enlightened and obviously quite pleased. I was going to say pleased with himself. I don't know about that. But at least very happy. And very special from all accounts. So they saw him and they said, "Wow, you seem very special. What are you? Are you some kind of an angel or a deva?" He seemed unhuman in some way. "No." "Well, are you some kind of a god then?" "No." "Well, are you some kind of a wizard or magician?" "No," he replied. "Well, are you a man?" "No," he said. "Then what are you?" And he answered, "I am awake." And in those 3 words, "I am awake," gave the whole teachings of what Buddhism contains. To be a Buddha is one who has awakened to the nature of life and death and the world in which we live, awakened to the body and mind. And so the practice of meditation from the Buddhist or other traditions is not to become a meditator or a spiritual person or a Buddhist, or join something, but it's rather to understand this capacity we have as humans to awaken. Now, what is that which we can awaken to? What is the Dharma which we can awaken to? Dharma is a Sanskrit and Pali word that refers to that which is universal, to the teachings and to the laws of the universe, teachings which describe it. And the Dharma, or the laws, the way things work, are always here to be discovered. They're quite immediate. So there's a story many of you old meditators who've come to these things will have heard before, of a pious man who very much believed in God. And one day, at the place where he dwelled, it started to rain heavily, and it rained, and a big flood came. And he went from his first floor to the second floor of his house, and the water rose until he was on the roof. Someone rode by and said, "Get in, my friend, I'll save you. The water's rising." He said, no, I believe in God. I really have faith. I believe. So he sent the rowboat away. It rained more and the water got all the way up to his neck, and another boat came by picking up people. Get in, my friend, I'll save you. No, thank you. I have trust. I've lived my whole life. I believe in God. No need. The rowboat goes away. It gets up to his nose, just barely can breathe, and a helicopter comes over and lowers down a rope. Come up, my friend, save you. No, thank you. I believe. I have faith. I trust. So the helicopter goes away. It rains some more, and he drowns. He goes to heaven after that. And after not very long there, he gets an interview with God, and it's his turn. So he goes in, you know, and he sits down and pays his respects and whatever. And then he says, you know, I just don't understand it. Here I was your faithful servant. I was so trusting and prayed and so believing. And I just don't understand what happened to me. And he sort of recounts all his circumstances. Where were you when I needed you? And God looks and kind of scratches his head and says, I don't understand it either. I sent you two rowboats and a helicopter. And we wait somehow for God to come as some big flash or our spiritual awakening to be some wonderful otherworldly experience. What the Dharma is and what we can awaken to is the truth that's here when we leave our fantasies and our memories and things behind and come into the present. When we do that and we start to pay attention, we start to see some of the characteristics of the Dharma or the life in which we live. One characteristic is impermanence. Thus shall you think of this fleeting world, it says in one Buddhist sutra. A star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, an echo, a rainbow, a phantom, and a dream. That as you look, the more closely you observe, the more you realize that everything you look at is in change. Seeing changes, hearing changes, smelling, tasting, physical sensations are changing. All the experience in the body and mind, all the experience of the senses. It seems solid. That's the illusion of santati. It's like a movie. And when you watch the screen and get caught in the story, it seems like it's very real. But then you turn your attention to the projector, or slow it down, or focus your awareness very carefully. It's even possible to do. And you start to see that it's one frame after another, one appearing in the next, dissolving in the next arising. And it's so for our life that it's really a process of change. Because that's so, because things don't last, unless you have something that lasts in your life, please raise your hand. If you do, has anyone gotten any mental states to last very long of any kind? Someone once raised their hand and said, yes, ignorance. It's lasted my whole life. But basically it's change. You sit down here and in one day, you don't even have to be a very adept meditator to get the point that it moves all the time, that it changes. And because things don't last, if we're attached to them being a certain way, what happens? This is one of the laws. What happens? We suffer. We get disappointed. Not because you should. You can be attached as much as you like. But even though you're attached, does it stop it from changing? You have a nice mental state and you try and hold on to it. Does it last anyway? So you start to see the laws of things, that things are impermanent, that attachment doesn't work, and that there must be some other way. There is actually what Alan Watts called the wisdom of insecurity, the ability to flow with things, to see them as changing process. You also see not only are they impermanent and ungraspable, that there's suffering if we're attached to them, and that there's pain as well as pleasure in this world. It's part of what we were born into. If you decide to get off on this planet and get one of these things with 10 little things on the end here and 10 little things on the end there and stuff that grows for a while and that you put old dead plants and animals in and mush them up in order to get it to kind of move around. If you choose one of these things, which you have, it's too late already, what is the nature of it? It grows up, it grows old, it dies, it gets sick sometimes. Sometimes it feels good and sometimes it hurts. There's pleasure and pain in it. Anybody have one that doesn't hurt sometimes? Okay. If you want that, you got to go to another planet because it's not the way things are here. So you sit and you see, I'm just going to be with my body and mind. I'm not doing anything, no big deal. And what do you find? You find sometimes it's pleasant and sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it's quiet. Sometimes it's restless. And you begin to relate to what Zorba called the whole catastrophe, all of it, instead of fearing the painful things and running away all the time and grasping after pleasant things, hoping that somehow by holding them they'll last, seeing that they don't. My teacher Ajahn Chah used to wander around the monastery at times and go up to people and just say, are you suffering much today? And depending what you'd answer, if you say yes, he said, oh, must be quite attached, and kind of giggle about it and go along. There wasn't much more to say. Okay. You see that you don't own it because it changes by itself, that you rent this house. You get it for a little while and you can honor it and feed it and walk it and jog it if you want. But it's not yours to possess. And you see, in fact, that none of these things are possessable because the nature of life is non-possession. You're an accountant in the firm. You get to count it for a while and that's all. So we sit to awaken, and we awaken by coming into our bodies and our senses and starting to see the laws which govern life so we can come into a wiser relationship with it. What does this mean for our lives? Well, this kind of teaching really teaches a way of wholeness and awareness, of bringing our body and mind together and our heart and our action, being conscious with our speech, conscious with our eating, conscious with walking, making it a part of what allows us to grow and live. And to do this means accepting the fact of impermanence and of some pain and suffering and of the fact that we don't control it very much. I mean, you control some of it, but not very much and in a really limited way. If you can't accept those things, then you will probably want to stay in your fantasy because they're what you encounter when you come here. Now, some people might ask, doesn't meditation fragment us away from the world? You say that it makes us more present. And it can if we become attached to solitude. If we see spiritual practice, we sit and try and get quiet and block everything out. Close your eyes and ears and nose or go into a cave. And it's not to say you shouldn't go and take a vacation in Yosemite or have periodic retreats. But fundamentally, for spiritual practice to be alive in our life, it has to be that we can use it in the supermarket, while we drive, when we're walking, when we're dealing with our family, to make all of it a part of it and not to escape. Someone might ask in the same vein as doesn't meditation fragment us from the world? I say it can if one tries to escape, but what we're training here is an awareness that can be used throughout our day. Well, what about social responsibility? We're on the brink of nuclear war. There's exploitation and injustice in every country. There are 40 wars going on right now in Iraq and Iran and El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala and Jordan and Israel and Lebanon and Cambodia still and Laos and, I don't know, Namibia and Angola and God knows where else, all these places. And it's not just a story. It's painful for millions of people, as is starvation, as is 50,000 nuclear warheads, which could literally destroy most of the human beings and many or most of the major animals that live on the planet in a painful way, easily, quickly. Now, one must listen to one's heart in this. It's interesting. You can make a compelling case for different sides. On one side, you can listen to Gandhi, who says, to come face to face with the universal, all-pervading truth, one must be able to love the meanest creatures as oneself. To do this, one cannot stay out of any field of life. Those who say religion has nothing to do with politics do not know what religion really means. And from that point of view, you see that what's necessary is not to sit, but to act. There is starvation. Nuclear war is imminent if we don't do something. There is a compelling need, even in this very rich and affluent society of people who are suffering in many ways. And what are we doing sitting around? It's quite convincing. There's another side which is equally convincing. And that is, what is the cause of that starvation and all those wars and that suffering? What do you think is the source of it? There's enough oil, there's enough food, there's enough resources on this planet. The cause of it is greed, and the cause of it is prejudice and hatred. We hate people who different religion, different skin color, different customs. We like our country, our family, our religion, our type. And so there's hoarding. And there's grasping and greed and hatred and ignorance. And we've tried through revolution for many centuries. It's helped in some ways, but in others it just keeps going around because we haven't touched the root of the problem. The root of the problem is for someone to discover what it means to not be caught up by anger, what it means to be free from that fear or that prejudice which arises in human hearts and minds. What it means to be unafraid of that which is painful as well as that which is pleasant. To be open, to have the heart open to all of what the world presents. So we don't need more oil and food as much as we need somebody who understands how not to get caught in anger and fear and prejudice. And that somebody is you. So instead of it being a luxury to meditate, from another point of view, it's a responsibility. For anyone who can, to figure out in their own being, in their own life, what it means not to be caught by these forces, to learn some new way, and then bring that to bear on the economic and social and political kinds of suffering as well in the world. It's a letter of mine that's a favorite, and I've read it many retreats. It's from a Nobel Prize winner named George Wald, who's a biologist at Harvard. He wrote it in response to an argument about the starting of a Nobel laureate's sperm bank. Some irate feminists wrote into the paper saying, sperm bank, they should have an egg bank. Why just sperm? He says, you're right, Pauline. It takes an egg as well as a sperm to start a Nobel laureate. Every one of them has had a mother as well as a father. And say all you want of fathers, their contribution to conception is really rather small. Nobel laureate society said there isn't much technically in the way of starting an egg bank. There are some problems, but nothing so hard as involve the other kinds of breeder reactors. But think of a man so vain as to insist on getting a superior egg from an egg bank. Then he has to fertilize it. And when it's fertilized, where does he go with it? To his wife? Here, dear, you can hear him saying, I just got this superior egg from an egg bank and just fertilized it myself. Will you take care of it? I've got eggs of my own to worry about, she replies. You know what you can do with your superior egg. Go rent a womb, and while you're at it, you better rent a room, too. You see, it just won't work, he says. For the truth is that what one really needs is not Nobel laureates, but love. How do you think one gets to be a Nobel laureate? Wanting love, that's how. Wanting it so bad one works all the time and ends up a Nobel laureate. It's a consolation prize. What matters is love. Forget sperm banks and egg banks. Banks and love are incompatible. If you don't know that, you don't know bankers. So just practice loving. Love a Russian. You'd be surprised how easy it is and how it will brighten up your morning. Love whales, Iranians, Vietnamese, not just here, but everywhere. When you've gotten really good, you can even try loving some of our politicians. So this is the other voice. It's the voice that says, in addition to the compelling social problems of our time, he said this amazing thing. Even the Nobel Prize is a consolation prize, because what human beings most want is to be honored, to be loved, to be recognized. And what the world most compellingly needs is someone who understands how not to get caught in these ancient human patterns of prejudice and fear and anger. Doesn't meditation make people withdraw from the world? Anyway, one has seen that for sure. There's a fine teaching in the Buddhist tradition of called the near enemies. The near enemy of love is attachment. It masquerades like love, it feels like it, but it's separate. It says, I love you, but really I'm attached to you and I need you out there to make me whole, rather than just the sense of love is honoring and seeing our connection. The near enemy to compassion is pity. Oh, that poor person, they're suffering. I don't suffer, not me certainly, but they all do, and the sort of separates them again. The near enemy to equanimity or balance of mind is indifference. It masquerades as equanimity, feels like, well, everything's fine, basically because I don't care about anybody. In not caring, we can find some peace. Real equanimity is when the heart begins to open and we find a capacity to experience all that the world presents with balance, with love, with openness. That it's not a running away from the world at all. It's really a sitting down right in the middle of it and paying attention to that which is pleasant and that which is painful, that which makes a lot of noise and that which is silent, and beginning to listen to our relationship to it, to observe it, to learn from it, and learn a wise way of relating. So then what is the heart of this inner way of practice? The heart of it is mindfulness, listening, attention, attention to our bodies, to all the various energies, to the voices, paying attention when we eat. Which voice do you listen to when you stop a meal? No, is it the belly which maybe speaks first and says, oh, had enough, comfortable, nice and full. And then the tongue chimes in, gee, but that fruit was so good, let's have a little more. And the eyes say, yeah, and there's more of that other stuff too that we haven't finished yet. And you hear all these different voices. To live in the feelings, to be aware of both emotions, to be aware of the pleasant and neutral and unpleasant aspect of our experience, and learn that we don't have to resist that which is painful and grasp that which is pleasant all the time. That's perhaps our conditioning, but in fact, it doesn't lead to peace. It doesn't lead to happiness. Because things change anyway. Even if you're attached to them, they change. It's an open-hearted and non-judging awareness which comes into the body and into the feelings and then observes the mind as well and its laws. The laws of karma, the laws of impermanence, and begins to see how to relate to it all out of compassion or kindness and wisdom, which means seeing how it's really operating. Sometimes it gets very painful when you sit. Sometimes it's pleasant and you have bliss and light, then you get attached. Sometimes it gets painful and then you want to avoid it. Thomas Merton said at one point, true prayer and love are learned in the hour when prayer becomes impossible and the heart is turned to stone. And sometimes it's in the very greatest difficulties in our sitting or in our life that our heart opens the most, or that we finally get the fact that we can't get attached to things and hold on to them, that they don't go the way we think, but the way that they go. And so wisdom begins to arise. How then to work with the basic difficulties which arise in meditation? What to do when there's physical pain? As best you can, sit and note pain, pain. Pay attention. See if you can notice how it changes. Sit comfortably. Don't make pain for yourself. There's plenty in this life without it. Start to pay attention to all of what makes up our reality. And that develops what is called in spiritual disciplines a heart of greatness. If you open the door to the outside, what do you get when you open it? You get whatever's out there. You get the weather for that day. And if you keep the door open, you get the weather changes. If you open your mind and your body and your heart, what do you get? You get everything. You get what's painful and what's pleasant. And there is a way to come to a new relationship of it. So in working with difficulties, desire, anger, restlessness, doubt, fear, these are the traditional list of hindrances which arise in meditation. How can one work with them? How can one make one's spiritual practice so that these become workable? There's a story in the community of George Gurdjieff of this obnoxious and very difficult man who finally left the community. He was having such a hard time, and Gurdjieff paid him to come back, and everyone was upset because they all had to pay a lot to live there, and here's Gurdjieff paying this old creepy guy who gets annoyed at everybody and is dirty. And they asked him why he did that, and he said, "This man is like yeast for bread. You know, without him, you wouldn't really learn the meaning of patience or compassion or loving kindness. You wouldn't learn that about yourself." So that when these states of mind arise, restlessness or desire or fear, wanting, if only it were somehow different than it is, or judgment, I don't like this, or worry or agitation, what to do with them? Sit in the very middle of them and study them. Note how they feel in the body. There's desire. Desire runs much of our world. You watch TV, that's all they sell is desire. Pay attention and see what it's like. How do you feel it in the body? What is it like in the mind? Give a clear and careful, mindful attention to it without getting caught, not suppressing it or trying to make it go away, and not getting involved, just noting desire, wanting, until you come to see its nature and you come to some balance where you're not so caught up in it or afraid of it. The same for anger. Most of us are either afraid of it and stuff it down, or we act it out. See if when judgment or anger arises, if you can just sit and note angry, furious, judging, whatever it is, and feel it. Just heat, movement, temperature, energy in the body, certain contraction, different qualities of mind. See if it's possible to experience that energy and learn from it. See how it changes, what it does to you, what its flavor, what the quality of it is, its effect on you. And then maybe you can learn not to be quite so caught in it. Doesn't mean it won't still come, heaven knows. But that your relationship to it can be a wiser one. Do it again and again. With fear, with all the kinds of mental states that come up, especially the difficult ones, until you can sit and allow them to come and go like cows or sheep in the meadows. Now, what if they're very strong? What if they're too difficult? They're really, really hard. What should you do? Say, you're so restless, you just can't stand it. What to do? Die. Okay? Be the first yogi to ever die of restlessness. Just say, fine, take me. Surrender to it and let it kill you. And what you discover if you do that is that, in a way, you die. What dies is your resistance to it. And that you just carry on. And you discover this powerful capacity we have, if you work with it, to open to all of our experience and find some balance in it. Now, if you're more advanced, if you've done practice for a while, you may also wish to work with this capacity one has of going into the very middle of something. There's desire or anger or fear or whatever it is, not just to feel it, but see if you can find the very center of it and discover what's there, or maybe go through the center in some way. Now, what about all the different kinds of meditation? Here one's learning Vipassana. How about Tibetan meditation or Zen or TM or so forth? There are a lot of good ways to practice. You know, there are these two students of a master who are arguing. One says, it's really good to sit very still and not move and just work with whatever pain comes. And the other one says, no, that's macho. You want to relax and be gentle and just be aware, but you don't make a lot of effort in it. And they're arguing, and they can't seem to get any answer, and they go to the master. And one says, you really got to make effort to bring your mind back and to stay very present and not to move. And that way you get through all this stuff. You learn how to be still in the middle of anything. And the master says, you're right. And the other one says, but wait a second. Don't you want to learn to be loving and gentle, to move if you really need to, and just to find a balance with it all, to be soft and not to struggle against it, simply to open? And the master says, you're right. And a third student who's sitting there says, but they can't both be right. The master said, and you're right too. Okay? There are a lot of good ways of meditation, many good ones. There are some that are better than others in the sense that some are only have a limited purpose, but there are many major schools of meditation which are wonderful. If they develop awareness or mindfulness of the body or the mind and the heart, our sense experience, and the laws where you observe how the world is working, they can bring you to liberation. They can bring you to freedom, any kind of meditation that does that. So it doesn't really matter which kind you've chosen. If you're doing Vipassana practice, wonderful. If what's accessible or interesting to you is Zen, fine. What's important is that you pick one and you stay with it and you do it. It takes discipline. If you want to learn to play piano, it takes more than just a day once in a while and a few minutes here and there. If you're lucky, after a year, you'll be able to play Happy Birthday to You. If you really want to learn something in a full way, tennis, piano, not to speak of training the mind and opening the heart, it takes perseverance and patience and a systematic training. Pick a practice. Use it, work with it every day, work with a teacher if you can, or in circumstances where you sit with other people. And in doing it over and over again, it starts to develop your capacity to open. It starts to train one to be more in the present moment. It starts to develop this sense of patience. It brings a kind of compassion when you sit and you really feel what's in there. Now, what to do if you actually attain something in meditation? People ask that sometimes. You should be so lucky is the first answer. But the second one, and the most important one, I remember when I went to my teacher Ajahn Chah after many adventures in meditating in other monasteries and different kinds of practice and experiences, and recounted them all to him, feeling kind of pleased with what I'd learned and how I'd open. And he just looked at me and he said, well, do you still have any greed? I said, yeah. He said, still got fear and anger? I said, yeah. Still got delusion? I said, uh-huh. He said, fine, continue. That was all he said, just continue. And so what you see is that meditation is not so much to attain some state of mind. They don't stay. You can't get them to stay. But to come to each moment with awareness, with a greater sense of openness of heart, and with a clear seeing. What can one learn of most value in all of this? Well, when people die, they tend to ask of themselves only a few questions. Commonly. Maybe just one or two. One might be, did I learn to live well, freely, honestly, authentically? And maybe even more fundamentally than that, did I love well? And all the other things one does, they have a certain measure of importance. But when it really comes down to it, have I loved well? When somebody says, okay, death comes to your left shoulder and taps you and says, this is your last dance, you get a few more thoughts and it's all over. What is your reflection to be? What do you care about? And what did you care about? And what meditation can open for us as a possibility in our sitting and even in the difficulties is this possibility of learning to be freer in the ups and downs and changes of life, in its pleasures and pains, and learning somehow to open and love, to be unafraid to express that love and to feel it in a full way. One of the most beautiful images for meditation which I've seen was a poster which showed this guru, Swami Satchitananda, wearing a little orange loincloth, his long flowing beard, a very handsome kind of Indian guru figure, who is also a fine teacher. And it showed him, he teaches yoga and meditation, many things, it showed him in the yoga posture standing on one leg like this. It's very graceful. Only he was balanced on a surfboard on a big wave. It was very impressive. Okay? And underneath it said, "You can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. Meditate with Swami Satchitananda," or something like that. Okay? It captured the spirit of meditation practice and the teachings of how to manifest it or bring it into a world that is full of senses, of sights and sounds and change. So the reason we go through all this trouble and do this strange-looking thing, to sort of sum up and finish this talk, is somehow to live more fully, to see the people that we live with, to see the trees, to be present when you go for a walk in the park and not be thinking about the bills that you need to pay and what happened yesterday, to live more fully here, to be able to love in a greater way by opening in ourselves to all the corners of our mind, to that which is difficult and that which is easy. And perhaps because it's our deepest desire to discover our true nature, to come to some sense of our oneness with life, or to understand who we are, or what all this strange thing that we got born into is about. Basically, it's the only game in town, if you look at it. Everything else is kind of transitory. And this is to pay attention and discover what the whole process of life and death are about. In order to do it, one needs to cultivate or practice mindfulness or awareness, to have it built on or foster some sense of inner stillness so that we can see and listen to all these things. And it requires courage. It's not such an easy thing. Only as a warrior, says Don Juan, a spiritual warrior, can one withstand the path of knowledge. A spiritual warrior cannot complain or regret anything. Their life is an endless challenge, and challenges cannot possibly be good or bad. The basic difference between an ordinary person and a warrior is that a warrior takes everything as a challenge, while an ordinary person takes everything as a blessing or a curse. And so it's a spirit of taking what comes to us and really working with it. That's a little bit heavy-handed in a way, even though I like it. And sometimes you take it as a challenge, and sometimes you do take it as a blessing or a curse, or you worry about it or complain. You can complain mindfully then, if that's what you want to do. Okay? You can learn from that as well as anything else. But the spirit of it is really one of opening, of discovery, of seeing. To sit, to walk, and to train yourself to bring the attention back, concentrate, mindful, balanced, to observe the breath, the body, the feelings, the mind, and all of the movement of what we got ourselves into, and see how one can relate to it at times in ways that cause pain, how one can learn to relate to it with wisdom, with loving kindness, with a greater sense of understanding and compassion. It's really not all that complicated. It's difficult to do sometimes, but it's not all that complicated. Someone once asked Aldous Huxley, as he was dying, if he could say what he'd learned in all of his experience with many spiritual teachers and gurus and much of his own spiritual life. And he said, "It's embarrassing to tell you this, but it seems to come down mostly to just learning to be kinder." To be kind, though, means that you have to be here. You have to be present for what's actually in one's experience. So that's a lot of words. I hope it gives you some sense of the purpose of our practice.
This concludes excerpts from a lecture, "Why Meditate?" with Jack Kornfield. Please turn the tape over and rewind for the continuation of our program, the first instructional class on the inner art of meditation.